Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 212, A Whole New World. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. You can see the entire and ever-expanding Knitting Out Loud catalog at www.knittingoutloud.com. Also, Knit Circus, the online magazine featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can examine the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. Also, holiday vacations and Craftlit take you on the road to Rhinebeck, and I got to meet with Diane on the road to Virginia, and she just cooks up the best stuff. We have all sorts of nifty things planned, and now that I am living amongst green leaves, I can barely contain my excitement for this trip because we will be experiencing fall colors of said green leaves, and I can't think of anything that's more beautiful. I know times are tough and things are tight, but if you have never seen autumn foliage, if there is any way you can put a deposit together, really, truly, seriously, it is not something you will ever regret. I remember the first time I got to experience a New England autumn. It was heartbreaking how breathtaking the colors can be, and especially when you get outside of the cities. I remember being told when we were in New York that although the colors in the city are beautiful, and Central Park is quite lovely, and Prospect Park is as well in Brooklyn, once you get out of the city and away from pollution, you find that the colors are far more intense than they were within the city. I'm kind of curious to see if our little corner of Northern Virginia will be the same way, that you really have to get out of the city to see these shockingly clear reds and yellows and oranges. Or if we're far enough away from D.C. itself, very close by train, but far enough by car, that the colors will be any good here as well. I am in my new office space. I have kicked the children out because the three of us will be sharing the office, which is going to be kind of interesting. But it's an early Sunday morning. I am looking out of my east-ish facing windows at big trees. They smell like ginkgo trees, but they're far too tall to be ginkgo, so I don't really have a clue what I'm looking at yet. I have to relearn East Coast flora and fauna. I've recognized the squirrels. Let's just say I've managed to accomplish that. And I think I saw an oak tree. But, you know, leaves in Arizona are smaller and fiercer than leaves out here in the East. Out here, everything is lush and soft and very, very green. I'm looking at like six different shades of green out my window, and I just marvel every time I do it, because Arizona's green is green, but it's a differently defined green. And there had been far less green in the last 2 years in Tucson because of the weather patterns changing. As I'm sure you've noticed, everything is getting more active and also less active, depending on which side of the country you're on. You know, the wet parts are getting wetter and the dry parts are getting drier, which is what, you know, people who worked with my dad in geography and remote sensing and desertification and things like that had pretty much been predicting for a while. So I have to say that I'm a little glad now that I'm here to be out of a place where water is about to become even more scarce than it already is. The price of water frightens me, honestly, everywhere, but especially in the Southwest. And particularly in Arizona, where, you know, California will beat up Arizona for water and drag Arizona into a dark alley and beat it senseless until it forks over all the water. And Arizona will cave. I'm fairly certain when when that happens, it will curl up into a little fetal ball and whimper because it can't fight back. Arizona was a crazy place to live. Now that I'm not there, I can say it. Beautiful, like the Grand Canyon. That was our first stop on our cross-country adventure. We started by going north into northern Arizona and the Grand Canyon, which I hadn't seen in years. And it was still there, which is always heartening. And it was still grand, which is also pretty good. And it was deep and big. And I was a little worried taking children there because I thought, I can look at it and understand what it took to create something like that. And maybe my now 11-year-old son would be able to understand and appreciate how nifty that all is. But I was kind of worried that the 7-year-old was going to walk up and go, wow, it's a big ditch. Let's go get food, and that would be the end of it. But no, in fact, he was mesmerized and wanted to go back the next morning and really, really was quite into it. So that was lovely. There are more details and tons of pictures on the road trip blog that I was writing until I ceased to have internet access. Sometimes it was because we were staying with friends and I just, it was 11:30 at night and I'd forgotten to ask the password for their internet. And sometimes it was just sheer exhaustion. Driving across the country by yourself is really taxing. Fun, beautiful, extraordinary, something everyone should do, but taxing. And because of that, the end of the blog got a little truncated. I will be adding more to it as I remember more of it. It all kind of became a blur towards the end. But the newsy bits, the highlights, or lowlights in the case of the first episode, we got to Salt Lake in the middle of a storm. This was our second day. It was a long drive from the Grand Canyon to Salt Lake City is a long drive. And my mom was with us that day because it was going to be such a long drive. Then she flew home out of Salt Lake in the middle of a rainstorm. And we drove around downtown and got to see the temple, which is, gorgeous, if you've never had a chance to see it. Different from how I remembered it as a child, but that's not really a shock now, is it? And then we went to hop on the highway and grab a coffee, which, there are Starbucks all over Salt Lake City, which indicates how much it has changed since 1983. Was that the last time I was in Salt Lake? Wow. Coffee and Coca-Cola products everywhere. So that was a surprise, really, because that just wasn't available back then. And I could get beer if I could drink a beer, I could have gotten it at a restaurant, which was also kind of unique. But I took advantage of the newfound caffeine and grabbed myself a big honkin' coffee for the drive out of Salt Lake. We should have been heading north to Yellowstone and Billings, Montana, but we got hit with a storm. Had I proceeded to drive north, I would have hit somewhere between 10 and 15 inches of snow in the same car where the universe tried to kill me driving in snow and ice. Now, we did have the advantage of one more decent tire, so it was still a two-wheel drive car with two good tires and kids in the back and a very loaded down back end, which I think actually was a good thing. It would have stabilized us some, but I'll tell you, having driven icy, windy, twisty roads in that car already with kids in the back, I wasn't about to do it alone. And I know that probably makes me chicken, and I'm sure that everyone in Billings, Montana thinks that I'm a horrible, horrible wuss, but I wasn't up to it. And so I wasn't able to go to Billings, and I was really upset about that because I'd been emailing with people from Billings and it looked like so much fun and it was really the class that I was looking forward to teaching, and it all got shot to garbanzo beans. So that bit. But honestly, getting out of Salt Lake at all, going over the little pass that you go over to get to Park City and then up into Wyoming, that was snowy. We got snowed on. It was May 27th, May 28th, and we got snowed. That was weird for us from Tucson, where it was already 102. So it was very interesting because that weather followed us all the way to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So we had incredibly mild, beautiful, kind of springish weather across South Dakota, still the undiscovered gem of the United States. Such gorgeous country and lovely people. Up into Minneapolis, St. Paul, where we got to see all of my Minneapolis, St. Paul friends who you also know of, Dawn from Crochet Compulsive and Jenny the Potter, and Jenny the Potter's mom, my traveling partner Lucinda from the London, Bath, and Wales trip, and Gretchen Funk, who is one of the designers in the Madame Defarge book, who is also the co-owner of the best punk club in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And you might think, ooh, punk club. Gee, Heather, why would you take your children to go have dinner at a punk bar? And the answer is this. It's a bar, sure, at night. But if you go for food during food times, you will get some of the best food you've ever had. The kids were mesmerized, and I personally felt at home. Not just because Gretchen and her husband have made it a warm, welcoming environment. The staff is great. The food is great. But because honestly, it looked like Brooklyn to me. We walked in. It's a long, narrow brick building. There's a concert space next door, but the actual bar itself where you would go in and eat, you know, wooden benches. I don't know. They looked kind of like recovered pews, you know, those kinds of long, thin wooden benches for seating. They had some of the tall benches. They have a bingo set for bingo night. I mean, how cool is that, right? And all of this in this great, tall-ceilinged, old brick building. And they've got original pictures of what it used to look like. It was just, it's, to me, this is what a bar or restaurant should be. This is the kind of place we went to in Brooklyn. This is the kind of place that, to me, feels like home. And these kinds of places don't exist in Tucson, except for maybe the Congress Hotel, but even the Cup Cafe, it's a different feel. So it was really wonderful. And then we got to see Diane in Eau Claire. We met up with Nina, one of our longtime listeners in Evanston. I got to see my brother and sister-in-law before my sister-in-law had her little baby girl who popped out this last week. It's just, it was such a great trip. We got to see old friends in Chicago, meet new friends at Loopy Yarns in Chicago, one of the best yarn stores ever. We got to see Dixie and Yellow Dog up in Eau Claire. We got to go to Indiana, which I haven't spent a significant amount of time in for too long. And we stayed with Laura and her husband, Chris, and their three children in a really gorgeous part of like dairy farming central in Indiana. You know, corn and cows was pretty much it. And limestone. If you saw the film Breaking Away from 100,000 years ago, the Cutters, which is the bike team from the movie Breaking Away, down further south in Indiana, but nonetheless a present part of Indiana kind of social lore and culture. Well, Laura has three children. I have two. Her children were amazing. And my kids, you know, once we got to Minneapolis, my kids started to see other kids and had kind of time to play with each other. But I'll tell you, they look back on their time in Indiana with Caleb and Rachel and Will, who were very concerned to find out how I was going to podcast about them. My boys spent time with the three of them and just, it was like they had been separated at birth. These kids just bonded and clicked so quickly. They were so smart and so fast and so funny. My boys had the best time, not just because there was an air hockey table. That wasn't the only reason. So Caleb and Rachel and Will, you three were one of the major highlights of our trip across the country. And three more spectacular children you just couldn't hope to find. We had a wonderful time. And then we went to Ohio and met with Shannon Oakey at Cooperative Press, got to see the offices, got to go swimming, got to have a nice dinner, and then we tootled on down to Virginia. And I had hoped to stop more places, but I'll tell you, once I hit Sioux Falls and had a good bottle of wine at Tucker's Walk Winery and a good night's sleep. I always sleep really well in South Dakota. I knew we just had to get home as fast as we could. Plus, let's see, in Chicago, I got the email that we may have sold the house. And so we actually thought that I was going to have to get to Ohio faster because it looked like we were going to have to do this massive document exchange, and Shannon had a fax machine, and so we were going to have to go there. But it turned out that we were able to take our time and still stop in Indiana and play with Laura and the kids. And we got to go to the Fair Oaks Dairy and see how a major, massive dairy farm works. This operation, I mean, man, it's like mobilizing for Iwo Jima. It was unbelievable how much planning goes in to getting milk on your table. So that was great. Cheese curds. Got some great cheese curds coming out of Wisconsin. Dawn and Jenny told us where to stop. So we were to, I'm not kidding, these are the directions. Drive until you get to the hanging semi, where they've suspended a semi from a sign. So it's, you know, its cab is up in the air and the rest of it's hanging down. Take that exit and then you wind around a bit and get to Carr Valley Cheeses, Carr, C-A-R-R. It's a family-owned cheesery. They, you know, let you test stuff. They also have a video on how cheese is made, so the boys got to watch that. And we bought some incredible 6-year cheddar, 4-year cheddar, mild cheddar, blue cheese, and for mama, cheese curds. So for those of you who have had cheese curds, you know that for the rest of the drive, my teeth were squeaky. I'm not sure why that happens. It's got to be something with the processing and the rennet and the non-digestedness of it. I have no idea. But I squeaked. And it was fun. So here we are now in Virginia, slowly unpacking and getting things set. If anybody has any clever ideas for how to organize a very small office space to include both office-y things and crafty things, oh, please add the link in the show notes. Because this is going to be a challenge. The bedrooms here are bigger than our bedrooms were in Arizona, which is nice, but the whole house is smaller and we're one bedroom short. So it's tight, but it's beautiful and we're all together again, and that makes Heather happy. So lots of things have been happening in the meantime, and I have some stuff to bring you up to date on. I just ended a sentence with a preposition, and that is something up with which we shall not put. So, here's some news. If you have been listening to ChopBard, you already know this. If you haven't, and you are a teacher, whether you think you are going to be teaching Shakespeare or not, I suggest you hustle over to the ChopBard website, and I've put a link in the show notes because Aaron Ziegler has written a book called Devouring Shakespeare, 5 Simple Tools, and I know it seems like it's kind of a mutual love fest between Aaron and me. And I guess in some ways it kind of is because, you know, we're kind of doing the same thing for different texts. And he does such a bloody good job of it. The book is wonderful. I read an early draft of it, or I read the final draft before he released it. And it's excellent and it's useful. And I suppose even if you're not a teacher, but you are interested in Shakespeare, I think he does a nice job of kind of synthesizing everything he has talked about in general about Shakespeare and kind of putting it all into one easy to read location. You know, he's very easy to listen to, and the book is also very easy to read. So he translated himself into book form very nicely. So that's great. And that's out and available now. And that is also why the incentive, the craft lit incentive for the end of June through July. So if you donate sometime between now and July 31st, you will be put into a drawing for your very own autographed copy signed to you of Aaron Ziegler's new book. How cool is that? So that is what you will be put into a drawing for if you donate. The other thing is there's a CD out called Cotton Spinning with the Tockley. It's a DVD by Joanne Ruane. And Joanne Ruane is in my old guild in Tucson. She is wonderful and she knows everything there is to know about spinning cotton. The reason I know this even exists, I knew she did the CDs. I think she has more than one, more than two even. But spinoff, the spring spinoff, has a review of this that's quite glowing. And so I was just happy to see her get the press and happy to see that people who don't know her personally appreciate her as much as the people in Tucson do, because she really is just a font of wisdom when it comes to this stuff. Plus, just a nice person and a really, really good teacher. So that was very exciting. And I have a link to the CD and information on it from the show notes. The Voyager Keyside sock book that I designed for, Knitting Socks from Around the World, is coming out July 1st now. And my socks are still on the cover, which is just thrilling. And more design books with this around the world theme are coming. There's going to be, you know, scarves and hats and mittens and gloves and things like that. But now they're also doing a sweater version of the book. And if that works out for me, it's been a little busy, you know. So I'm working up sketches and designs and stuff. And I'm very hopeful that this is going to happen. And then eventually there will be a matching sweater to go along with the hat, scarf, mitten, sock set coming to you from Keyside Publishing. It's kind of exciting stuff. And again, if you are in the Northern Virginia-ish area of the country, please don't hesitate to contact me. I'm compiling lists of names and potential babysitters and places to go and things to do with kids over the summer, and yarn stores and spinning stores and guilds and all of this, because I know nothing. I barely have a grip on where we are actually physically located on a map. And it makes me very nervous, actually, as the daughter of a geographer, to be somewhere and not really know where I am in kind of the grand scheme of things. I remember when I first moved to New York, it completely unnerved me that if a disaster struck, I didn't know how to get out. I mean, I knew there's the Lincoln Tunnel. I knew there's a Brooklyn Bridge. But I didn't really understand where we were. Like, if I got to Staten Island, is it really an island? Or do they just call it that? You know, it was... I'm in that same kind of twilight zone right now. I'm slowly starting to drive places and have a feeling for where we are. I had been joking in Tucson that if you turn left at the Manassas battlefield, you'll get to us. And actually, that's not true. It's more you kind of turn up and to the right and you get to us from the Manassas battlefield. And of course, right now it is Civil War a-go-go around here. There are all sorts of reenactments and things that are happening. And yesterday we were coming back from the city, we went into the city and saw the Hirshhorn Sculpture Garden off of the mall, and the boys wanted to go into the Hirshhorn, which is a modern art museum, and it's part of the Smithsonian, so it's free. So we just wandered in, and then we came home, and we were getting into the car, and we started hearing these explosions, and I was going, gosh, that's not fireworks. What's going on? It was some reenactment of something, because there were cannons going off. So that was different. But, you know, it's kind of wonderful to be that steeped in history. You know, swing a dead chicken and you hit a Civil War battlefield around here, and it's kind of nice. I like being back in that. Up in Croton, we had the Battle of Yorktown Heights that they reenacted every year, you know, 3 miles away from us in Yorktown. And I remember being really blown away by the historical work that was being done to preserve information for just, you know, regular people so that we would understand a little bit more about what had been going on. Now, I know that one of your burning questions about me being in Virginia now is, have you gotten bitten by mosquitoes yet? And the answer is, of course. And the follow-up to that is, and of course I haven't slept. And the follow-up to the follow-up is, and so, of course, at 3 a.m. the other night, I was online looking up mosquito bite reaction stoppers, and I found some very interesting things. Those of us who are most susceptible to being bit are also most likely those who have this weird virulent reaction. So that kind of stinks. But the other thing I learned is that antiperspirant, not deodorant, antiperspirant can often help mitigate, not stop, but mitigate the horrible reaction. Who knew? That and clear nail polish. So I, last night, applied boiling tea bags and boiling rubbing alcohol and antiperspirant and nail polish to mosquito bite sites. The hot boiling tea bags went on all of them, and then I split the difference between nail polish and antiperspirant. And I think the nail polish won, but the nail polish didn't work on its own. First, I had to do the boiling tea bag, and I'm assuming that's because I had to open up the pores a little bit so that the painful application of the nail polish would do some work. And then with one set of mosquito bites, they were really so itchy, I wrapped my leg in a bandage so that nothing could rub against it, because anytime even the wind blows against it, it makes it itch more. So I might have found my solution. I think the combination strike. Plus, I'm taking B1 vitamins and garlic, which is supposed to help change how you smell. I'm sure my husband is going to love this. Oh, you smell like garlic all the time now. But I figure, you know, anything when you're living in a climate this damp and this overrun by biting things, especially this early in the season, I really have to do whatever I can to stop the craziness. And the last thing before we get to the book, because I haven't forgotten, after half an hour of yammering, I haven't forgotten that there is a book. Really, I haven't. And it's wonderful, and it's getting better. I got a very, I thought, important and heartfelt email from a listener pretty much right as I left for the trip and couldn't do anything about it. And I was upset, not because the email wasn't accurate, but I was upset because I couldn't get to fix it any faster. But the email came from a listener in Norway, and I thought her comments were actually things that I'd been feeling and been frustrated with myself. But once I saw it from someone else's perspective, it was fairly easy to tell that the last 8 months have really walloped me. And between trying to get a book out, not trying to, getting a book out, and being the single mom and teaching and moving and starting a business and all of these things at once, it was like a perfect storm of stupid. And it kind of de facto changed the podcast. I think I've been talking faster because I didn't have that much time to podcast. And also because we've been, you know, we've had negative money for 8 months. I had stopped getting magazines. I'd stopped, and it wasn't like I'd stopped getting them. I'd stopped looking at magazines because I couldn't buy anything. And so the easiest way not to buy anything for me was to not go to a store and not window shop and not look at magazines. And if I went to the library, it was with the kids and I knit while they were looking at books. I didn't even look at the magazines at the library. And that's fine. And I think that's, for me, a very good way to avoid feeling like you're denying yourself everything, even though you are. But what it meant is that I've been living under a rock for the last 8 months. And the tunnel vision and under a rockness of all of it, I think, meant that, you know, there was no data coming in, and therefore there was very little data coming out on the podcast. You know, the craftiness that I'd been able to bring you, or knitting information or whatever, had been extremely limited. And I think I stopped being interesting in a lot of ways. Tunnel vision, I think, is a good way to describe it. And I know that there are plenty of good reasons for why that happened, but I remember my second year of teaching, realizing that I'd become quite a boring person because when I was teaching, I couldn't go anywhere or do anything. For one thing, I didn't have any money back then either. And for another thing, you know, I had to get up crazy early to teach, so I couldn't go out and do anything, and I was always grading papers. And so I kind of realized, ooh, I've gotten back to that same place, and I'm going to have to do something about that. And of course, now that I'm here and surrounded by all sorts of nifty stuff, it makes it a little easier. But, you know, my husband has work now. That's good. And I sort of almost kind of have a business started. And as soon as the boys are back in school, I'll be able to work more on that again. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can kind of get back to the way the podcast was before. So I can't make any promises that it's going to change in a hurry, but I can promise that I am trying. And part of that trying is also to try and get back to where I was at before with doing extras for the Craftlit Android and iPhone and iTouch application. I'd been doing extras. I'm collecting stuff now. So there will be more audio and short stories and just extra little tidbits that will be coming out on the application the way it was intended to be in the first place. So I will try to go back to the old ways a bit more because I miss it. I miss it too. Like knitting. I have two new babies in my family now, a cousin and then my niece. I finally am an auntie. And so I'm knitting a baby kimono for my little niece from the first Mason-Dixon book, the really super crazy easy baby kimono. I'm doing it in cotton, not the peaches and cream, but the denim. I don't know, is it Patton's denim yarn? I have no idea. I don't even have a ball band anymore. I just have this stuff laying around from 100 years ago. And it's the light blue denim, and I'm going to over dye it yellow with some yellow cotton dye that I have. And that'll turn it green and yellow, which kind of speckly, which I think will be very bright for her. And then I got some wonderful from our local yarn store, Uniquities, which I loved. I got some Lorna's Laces Shepherd Worsted. This is 100% superwash merino. It's in like candy colors, not jewel tones, but bright candy colors. So it's pink and purple and blue and yellow and kind of creamsicle orange and pale green. Let's see. Oh, and perfect. The colorway's name is Child's Play. So I got enough of this to make two little hoodies for the two girls in the family. One named after my mother-in-law who passed away the night that I got pregnant with Thing One, and one named after Gigi, her mom, Vera, who passed away while I was doing the podcast. And so the two girls are named for these two fabulous women that had been in all of our lives. So that was very happy. You know, in Jewish tradition, you don't name children after someone who's still alive, but anyone who's passed on, you have free rein to steal their name and use it for your own child. So it was kind of nice that the first two girls who were born after these two fabulous women passed away, they were commemorated by name. So that was very exciting. And I'm an auntie, and that's great. And with all of this happy new stuff going on, I now drag you back to the drama that is unfolding in The Woman in White. So when last I left you, or more accurately, when last Walter left you, we have learned that Marion has recovered Laura, which is great, but that Laura is so wasted and so not herself, both in mind and physically, that no one else recognizes her, which is a problem because everybody thinks that they buried her. And nobody really knew Anne Catherick. So it makes it very difficult for anyone to look at Laura in her wasted state and see Laura instead of seeing this other woman who they never really met, but they kind of heard about. And so Laura is stuck and Marion is stuck with her. And Walter, good old Walter, is sticking by them. Now, there are, I think, in today's episode, there are a couple of times when your modern sensibilities, you women out there, are probably going to go like that. Do remember to put this in context. And do remember that Marion iconoclastic though she may be, breaking molds left, right, and center, she is still a woman in Wilkie Collins' time period. And Wilkie, as much of a, I'm going to go out there and use the term radical feminist, as he was, and I really do, I mean, he put more into the hands of female characters in this book than, well, I mean, to me, he's up there with Hawthorne as far as writing strong female characters. You know, I think of Hester as being an intensely strong female presence in a novel. And Marion is just, you know, kicking butt and taking names. She is just on fire. Well, you're going to start to see the toll it's taking on her soon. Not that she stops and not that she's weak, but just that you're going to hear comments coming out of her mouth that you probably didn't expect to hear. Just a couple, not a big deal. I'm making more of a deal of it than it really is. But that's because you're going to hear that popping up from time to time as we continue on. So today we pick up with Walter, and he lets us know how they have situated themselves physically and financially and legally, and I found this chapter really interesting because I hadn't thought about it, and now that I see how Walter had to arrange things, it reveals a lot about, well, a few things. I think actually their solution makes perfect sense to us today, but I think it must have been rather radical back then. I'm curious. I've actually tried to find reviews of, and I know I need, what the problem is, I need to find a university research library to pull this off, but I've been looking to see if there are any reviews that talk about this part of the book that were written back in the 1860s, because I'm very curious to find out how people back then responded to the setup, which is revealed in this chapter. The other thing that happens in this chapter is the inevitable visit to a lawyer, and that's heartbreaking. So it's so there's some good stuff here. We also have a little imposition by Count Fosco, which, as you know, always makes me happy because he's such a bloody good character. I love this character. He's such a wonderfully complicated bad guy, and getting a good bad guy is not easy. I remember, I don't know if I've ever told you guys this, I remember when we were working on Aladdin, at some point there was a conversation about Jafar and Aladdin in the showdown, and somewhere there had been some suggestion about doing something where Jafar makes some enormous mistake, and because of that, Aladdin wins. And I seem to recall that the scriptwriters and the head of story were all dead set against this. And it was because to them, if you want a story to be good, your villain has to be extraordinary, because that forces your hero to rise to the occasion and become, therefore, by default, more heroic. And this is a problem that you see with books and movies all the time, is that whoever the bad person is, or whoever the conflict is with, they mess up somehow, or they're just not that bright, or they're not that big a challenge. And therefore, you know, your reaction is, well, okay, I guess that's, you know, that was fun. In a story with a good antagonist, it forces all of the characters to raise their game. And that, I think, is one of the main benefits of Fosco. I mean, Percival's a jerk, and Percival has his truly nasty, evil moments, but he isn't the brains of the operation. You know what I mean? It's Fosco. It comes down to Fosco. And so we get a little bit of Fosco today. And Fosco will keep, you know, popping up all sorts of places where you least expect him. And we will all love him for that. So that's really all there is about today. So I will now turn you over to Walter Hartwright and...
The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Read by...
Tim Bulkley. Off BigBible.org.
Glenn Hallstrom, a.k.a. Smokestack Jones.
The Third Epoch. 3. This was the story of the past. The story, so far as we knew it then. Two obvious conclusions presented themselves to my mind after hearing it. In the first place, I saw darkly what the nature of the conspiracy had been, how chances had been watched, and how circumstances had been handled to ensure impunity to a daring and intricate crime. While all the details were still a mystery to me, the vile manner in which the personal resemblance between the woman in white and Lady Glyde had been turned to account was clear beyond a doubt. It was plain that Anne Catherick had been introduced into Count Fosco's house as Lady Glyde. It was plain that Lady Glyde had taken the dead woman's place in the asylum, the substitution having been managed as to make innocent people, the doctor and the two servants certainly, and the owner of the madhouse in all probability, accomplices in the crime. The second conclusion came as the necessary consequence of the first. We three had no mercy to expect from Count Fosco and Sir Percival Glyde. The success of the conspiracy had brought with it a clear gain for those two men of £30,000, £20,000 to one, £10,000 to the other through his wife. They had that interest, as well as other interests, in ensuring their impunity from exposure, and they would leave no stone unturned, no sacrifice unattempted, no treachery untried, to discover the place in which their victim was concealed, and to part her from the only friend she had in the world, Marian Halcombe and myself. The sense of this serious peril, a peril which every day and every hour might bring nearer and nearer to us, was the one influence that guided me in fixing the place of our retreat. I chose it in the far east of London, where there were fewest idle people to lounge and look about them in the streets. I chose it in a poor and populous neighbourhood, because the harder the struggle for existence among the men and women about us, the less the risk of their having time or taking the pains to notice chance strangers who came among them. These were the great advantages I looked to. But a locality was a gain to us also in another and hardly less important respect. We could live cheaply by the daily work of my hands, and could save every farthing we possessed to forward the purpose, the righteous purpose, of redressing an infamous wrong, which, from first to last, I now kept steadily in view. In a week's time, Marian Halcombe and I had settled how the course of our new lives should be directed. There were no other lodgers in the house, and we had the means of going in and out without passing through the shop. I arranged, for the present at least, that neither Marian nor Laura should stir outside the door without my being with them, and that in my absence from home they should let no one into their rooms on any pretense whatsoever. This rule established, I went to a friend whom I had known in former days, a wood engraver in large practice, to seek for employment, telling him at the same time that I had reasons for wishing to remain unknown. He at once concluded that I was in debt and expressed his regret in the usual forms, and then promised to do what he could to assist me. I left his false impression undisturbed, and accepted the work he had to give. He knew that he could trust my experience and my industry. I had what he wanted, steadiness and facility, and, though my earnings were but small, they sufficed for our necessities. As soon as we could feel certain of this, Marian Halcombe and I put together what we possessed. She had between £200 and £300 left of her own property, and I had nearly as much remaining from the purchase money obtained by the sale of my drawing master's practice before I left England. Together we made up between us more than £400. I deposited this little fortune in a bank, to be kept for the expense of those secret inquiries and investigations which I was determined to set on foot, and to carry on by myself if I could find no one to help me. We calculated our weekly expenditure to the last farthing, and we never touched our little fund, except in Laura's interests and for Laura's sake. The housework, which, if we had dared trust a stranger near us, would have been done by a servant, was taken on the first day, taken as her own right by Marian Halcombe. "What a woman's hands are fit for," she said. "Early and late, these hands of mine shall do." They trembled as she held them out, The wasted arms told their sad story of the past. As she turned up the sleeves of the poor, plain dress that she wore for safety's sake, and the unquenchable spirit of the woman burnt bright in her even yet. I saw the big tears rise thick in her eyes and fall slowly over her cheeks as she looked at me. She dashed them away with a touch of her old energy and smiled with a faint reflection of her old good spirits. "Don't doubt my courage, Walter," she pleaded. "It's my weakness that cries, not me. The housework shall conquer it if I can't." And she kept her word. The victory was won when we met in the evening, and she sat down to rest. Her large, steady black eyes looked at me with a flash of their bright firmness of bygone days. "I'm not quite broken down yet," she said. "I'm worth trusting with my share of the work." Before I could answer, she added in a whisper, "And worth trusting with my share in the risk and the danger, too. Remember that if the time comes." I did remember it when the time came. As early as the end of October, the daily course of our lives had assumed its settled direction, and we three were as completely isolated in our place of concealment as if the house we lived in had been a desert island, and the great network of streets and the thousands of our fellow creatures all around us the waters of an illimitable sea. I could now reckon on some leisure time for considering what my future plan of action should be, and how I might arm myself most securely at the outset for the coming struggle with Sir Percival and the Count. I gave up all hope of appealing to my recognition of Laura, or to Marian's recognition of her in proof of her identity. If we had loved her less dearly, if the instinct implanted in us by that love had not been far more certain than any exercise of reasoning, far keener than any process of observation, even we might have hesitated on first seeing her. The outward changes wrought by the suffering and the terror of the past had fearfully, almost hopelessly, strengthened the fatal resemblance between Anne Catherick and herself. In my narrative of events at the time of my residence in Limeridge House, I've recorded, from my own observation of the two, how the likeness, striking as it was when viewed generally, failed in many important points of similarity when tested in detail. In those former days, if they had both been seen together side by side, no person could for a moment have mistaken them one for the other, as has happened often in the instance of twins. I could not say this now. The sorrow and suffering, which I had once blamed myself for associating even by a passing thought with the future of Laura Fairley, had set their profaning marks on the youth and beauty of her face, and the fatal resemblance which I had once seen and shuddered at seeing in idea only was now a real and living resemblance which asserted itself before my own eyes. Strangers, acquaintances, friends even, who could not look at her as we looked, if she had been shown to them in the first days of her rescue from the asylum, might have doubted if she were the Laura Fairley they had once seen, and doubted without blame. The one remaining chance, which I had at first thought might be trusted to serve us, the chance of appealing to her recollection of persons and events which no impostor could be familiar, was proved, by the sad test of our later experience, to be hopeless. Every little caution that Marian and I practiced towards her, every little remedy we tried to strengthen and steady slowly the weakened, shaken faculties, was a fresh protest in itself against the risk of turning her mind back on the troubled and terrible past. The only events of the former days which we ventured on encouraging her to recall were the little trivial domestic events of that happy time at Limeridge, when I first went there and taught her to draw. The day when I roused those remembrances by showing her the sketch of the summer house which she'd given me on the morning of our farewell, and which had never been separated from me since, was the birthday of our first hope. Tenderly and gradually, the memory of the old walks and drives dawned upon her, and the poor, weary, pining eyes looked at Marian and at me with a new interest, with a faltering thoughtfulness in them, which from that moment we cherished and kept alive. I bought her a little box of colours and a sketchbook, like the old sketchbook which I'd seen in her hands on the morning that we first met. Once again, oh me, once again, at the spare hours saved from my work, in the dull London light, in the poor London room. I sat by her side to guide the faltering touch, to help the feeble hand. Day by day I raised and raised the new interest till its place in the blank of her existence was at last assured, till she could think of her drawing and talk of it, and patiently practice it by herself, with some faint reflection of the innocent pleasure in my encouragement, the growing enjoyment in her own progress, which belonged to the lost life and the lost happiness of past days. We helped her mind, slowly, by this simple means. We took her out between us to walk on fine days, in the quiet old city square near at hand, where there was nothing to confuse or alarm her. We spared a few pounds from the fund at the banker's to get her wine, and the delicate strengthening food that she required. We amused her in the evenings with children's games at cards, with scrapbooks full of prints which I borrowed from the engraver, who employed me. By these and other trifling attentions like them, we composed her and steadied her, and hoped all things, as cheerfully as we could from time and care, that love that never neglected and never despaired of her. But to take her mercilessly from seclusion and repose, to confront her with strangers or with acquaintances who were little better than strangers, to rouse the painful impressions of her past life, which we had so carefully hushed to rest, this, even in her own interests, we dared not do. Whatever sacrifices it cost, whatever long, weary, heartbreaking the delays it involved, the wrong that had been inflicted on her, if mortal means could grapple it, must be redressed without her knowledge and without her help. This resolution settled, it was necessary to decide how the first risk should be ventured, and what the first proceeding should be. After consulting with Marian, I resolved to begin by gathering together as many facts as could be recollected, and then to ask the advice of Mr. Kyle, whom we knew we could trust, and to ascertain from him in the first instance if the legal remedy lay fairly within our reach. I owed it to Laura's interests not to stake her whole future on my own unaided exertions, so long as there was the faintest prospect of gaining our position by obtaining reliable assistance of any kind. The first source of information to which I applied was the journal kept at Blackwater Park by Marian Holcombe. There were passages in this diary relating to myself which she thought it best that I should not see. Accordingly, she read to me from the manuscript, and I took the notes I wanted as she went on. We could only find time to pursue this occupation by sitting up late at night. Three nights were devoted to the purpose, and were enough to put me in possession of all that Marian could tell. My next proceeding was to gain as much additional evidence as I could procure from other people without exciting suspicion. I went myself to Mrs. Vasey to ascertain if Laura's impression of having slept there was correct or not. In this case, from consideration for Mrs. Vasey's age and infirmity, and in all subsequent cases of the same kind from considerations of caution, I kept our real position a secret, and was always careful to speak of Laura as the late Lady Glyde. Mrs. Vasey's answer to my inquiries only confirmed the apprehensions which I previously felt. Laura had certainly written to say she would pass the night under the roof of her old friend, but she had never been near the house. Her mind in this instance, and as I feared in other instances beside, confusedly presented to her something which she had only intended to do in the false light of something which she had really done. The unconscious contradiction of herself was easy to account for in this way, but it was likely to lead to serious results. It was a stumble on the threshold at starting. It was a flaw in the evidence which told fatally against us. When I next asked for the letter which Laura had written to Mrs. Vasey from Blackwater Park, it was given to me without the envelope, which had been thrown into the waste-paper basket and long since destroyed. In the letter itself no date was mentioned, not even the day of the week. It only contained these lines: "Dearest Mrs. Vasey, I am in sad distress and anxiety, and I may come to your house tomorrow night and ask for a bed. I can't tell you what is the matter in this letter. I write it in such fear of being found out that I can fix my mind on nothing. Pray be at home to see me. I will give you 1,000 kisses and tell you everything. Your affectionate Laura." What help was there in those lines? None. On returning from Mrs. Vasey's, I instructed Marion to write, observing the same caution which I practised myself to Mrs. Mitchelson. She was to express, if she pleased, some general suspicion of Count Fosco's conduct, and she was to ask the housekeeper to supply us with a plain statement of events in the interests of truth. While we were waiting for the answer, which reached us in a week's time, I went to the doctor in St. John's Wood, introduced myself as sent by Miss Halcombe to collect, if possible, more particulars of her sister's last illness than Mr. Kyle had found the time to procure. By Mr. Goodrick's assistance, I obtained a copy of the certificate of death, and an interview with the woman, Jane Gould, who had been employed to prepare the body for the grave. Through this person I also discovered a means of communicating with the servant, Hester Pinhorn. She had recently left her place in consequence of a disagreement with her mistress, and she was lodging with some people in the neighbourhood whom Mrs. Gould knew. In the manner here indicated, I obtained the narratives of the housekeeper, of the doctor, of Jane Gould, and of Hester Pinhorn, exactly as they are presented in these pages. Furnished with such additional evidence as these documents afforded, I considered myself to be sufficiently prepared for a consultation with Mr. Kyle, and Marion wrote accordingly to mention my name to him, and to specify the day and hour at which I requested to see him on private business. There was time enough in the morning for me to take Laura out for her walk as usual, and to see her quietly settled at her drawing afterwards. She looked up at me with a new anxiety in her face as I rose to leave the room, and her fingers began to toy doubtfully, in the old way, with the brushes and pencils on the table. "You're not tired of me yet," she said. "You're not going away because you're tired of me. I will try to do better. I will try to get well. Are you as fond of me, Walter, as you used to be, now I'm so pale and thin and so slow in learning to draw?" She spoke as a child might have spoken, showed me her thoughts as a child might have shown me them. I waited a few minutes longer, waited to tell her that she was dearer to me now than she had ever been in past times. "Try to get well again," I said, encouraging the new hope in the future which I saw dawning in her mind. "Try to get well again, for Marion's sake and for mine." "Yes," she said to herself, returning to her drawing, "I must try, because they are both so fond of me." She suddenly looked up again. "Don't be gone long. I can't get on with my drawing, Walter, when you're not here to help me." "I shall be back soon, my darling. Soon be back to see how you're getting on." My voice faltered a little in spite of me. I forced myself from the room. It was no time then for parting with the self-control which might yet serve me in my need before the day was out. As I opened the door, I beckoned to Marion to follow me to the stairs. It was necessary to prepare her for a result which I felt might sooner or later follow my showing myself openly in the streets. "I shall in all probability be back in a few hours," I said. "And you will take care, as usual, to let no one inside the doors in my absence." "But if anything happens..." "What can happen?" she interposed quickly. "Tell me plainly, Walter. If there's any danger, I shall know how to meet it." "The only danger," I replied, "is that Sir Percival Glyde may have been recalled to London by the news of Laura's escape. You are aware that he had me watched before I left England, and that he probably knows me by sight, although I don't know him." She laid her hand on my shoulder and looked at me in anxious silence. I saw she understood the serious risk that threatened us. "It's not likely," I said, "that I shall be seen in London again so soon, either by Sir Percival himself or by the persons in his employ. But it is barely possible that an accident may happen. In that case you will not be alarmed if I fail to return to-night, and you will satisfy any inquiry of Laura's with the best excuse you can make for me. If I find the least reason to suspect that I'm watched, I will take good care that no spy follows me back to this house. Don't doubt my return, Marion, however it may be delayed, and fear nothing." "Nothing," she answered firmly. "You shall not regret, Walter, that you have only a woman to help you." She paused and detained me a moment longer. "Take care," she said, pressing my hand anxiously. "Take care." I left her and set forth to pave the way for discovery, the dark and doubtful way, which began at the lawyer's door. 4. No circumstances of the slightest importance happened on my way to the offices of Messrs. Gilmore and Kyle in Chancery Lane. While my car was being taken in to Mr. Kyle, a consideration occurred to me which I deeply regretted not having thought of before. The information derived from Marion's diary made it a matter of certainty that Count Fosco had opened her first letter from Blackwater Park to Mr. Kyle, and had, by means of his wife, intercepted the second. He was, therefore, well aware of the address of the office, and he would naturally infer that if Marion wanted advice and assistance, after Laura's escape from the asylum, she would apply once more to the experience of Mr. Kyle. In this case, the office in Chancery Lane was the very first place which he and Sir Percival would cause to be watched. And if the same persons were chosen for the purpose who had been employed to follow me before my departure from England, the fact of my return would in all probability be ascertained on that very day. I had thought generally of the chances of being recognized in the streets, but the special risk connected with the office had never occurred to me until the present moment. It was too late now to repair this unfortunate error in judgment, too late to wish that I had made arrangements for meeting the lawyer in some place privately appointed beforehand. I could only resolve to be cautious on leaving Chancery Lane, and not to go straight home again under any circumstances whatever. After waiting a few minutes, I was shown into Mr. Kyle's private room. He was a pale, thin, quiet, self-possessed man, with a very attentive eye, a very low voice, and a very undemonstrative manner. Not, as I judged, ready with his sympathy where strangers were concerned, and not at all easy to disturb in his professional composure. A better man for my purpose could hardly have been found. If he committed himself to a decision at all, and if the decision was favourable, the strength of our case was as good as proved from that moment. "Before I enter on the business which brings me here," I said, "I ought to warn you, Mr. Kyle, that the shortest statement I can make of it will occupy some little time." "My time is at Miss Halcombe's disposal," he replied. "Where any interests of hers are concerned, I represent my partner personally as well as professionally. It was at his request that I should do so, when he ceased to take an active part in business. May I inquire whether Mr. Gilmore is in England?" "He is not. He is living with his relatives in Germany. His health has improved, but the period of his return is still uncertain." While we were exchanging these few preliminary words, he had been searching among papers before him, and he now produced from them a sealed letter. I thought he was about to hand the letter to me, but apparently changing his mind, he placed it by itself on the table, settled himself in his chair, and silently waited to hear what I had to say. Without wasting a moment in prefatory words of any sort, I entered on my narrative, and put him in full possession of the events which had already been related in these pages. Lawyer as he was to the very marrow of his bones, I startled him out of his professional composure. Expressions of incredulity and surprise, which he could not repress, interrupted me several times before I had done. I persevered, however, to the end, and as soon as I reached it, boldly asked the one important question. "What is your opinion, Mr. Kyle?" He was too cautious to commit himself to an answer, without taking time to recover his self-possession first. "Before I give you my opinion," he said, "I must beg permission to clear the ground by a few questions." He put the questions, sharp, suspicious, unbelieving questions, which clearly showed me as they proceeded that he thought I was the victim of a delusion, and that he might even have doubted, but for my introduction to him by Miss Halcombe, whether I was not attempting the perpetration of a cunningly designed fraud. "Do you believe that I have spoken the truth, Mr. Kyle?" I asked, when he had done examining me. "So far as your own convictions are concerned, I am certain you have spoken the truth," he replied. "I have the highest esteem for Miss Halcombe, and I have therefore every reason to respect a gentleman whose mediation she trusts in a matter of this kind. I will even go further, if you like, and admit, for courtesy's sake and for argument's sake, that the identity of Lady Glyde, as a living person, is a proved fact to Miss Halcombe and yourself. But you come to me for a legal opinion. As a lawyer, and as a lawyer only, it is my duty to tell you, Mr. Hartright, that you have not a shadow of a case. You put it strongly, Mr. Kyle. I will try to put it plainly as well. The evidence of Lady Glyde's death is, on the face of it, clear and satisfactory. There is her aunt's testimony to prove that she came to Count Fosco's house, that she fell ill, and that she died. There is the testimony of the medical certificate to prove the death, and to show that it took place under natural circumstances. There is the fact of the funeral at Limeridge, and there is the assertion of the inscription on the tomb. That is the case you want to overthrow. What evidence have you to support the declaration on your side that the person who died and was buried was not Lady Glyde? Let us run through the main points of your statement and see what they are worth. Miss Halcombe goes to a certain private asylum, and there seeks a certain female patient. It is known that a woman named Anne Catherick, and bearing an extraordinary personal resemblance to Lady Glyde, escaped from the asylum. It is known that a person received there last July was received as Anne Catherick, brought back. It is known that the gentleman who brought her back warned Mr. Fairley that it was part of her insanity to be bent on impersonating his dead niece, and it is known that she did repeatedly declare herself in the asylum, where no one believed her, to be Lady Glyde. These are all facts. What have you to set against them? Miss Halcombe's recognition of the woman, which recognition, after events, invalidate or contradict? Does Miss Halcombe assert her supposed sister's identity to the owner of the asylum, and take legal means for rescuing her? No, she secretly bribes a nurse to let her escape. When the patient has been released in this doubtful manner, and is taken to Mr. Fairley, does he recognize her? Is he staggered for one instant in his belief of his niece's death? No. Do the servants recognize her? No. Is she kept in the neighborhood to assert her own identity and to stand the test of further proceedings? No. She is privately taken to London. In the meantime, you have recognized her also, but you are not a relative. You are not even an old friend of the family. The servants contradict you, and Mr. Fairley contradicts Miss Halcombe. And the supposed Lady Glyde contradicts herself. She declares she passed the night in London at a certain house. Your own evidence shows that she has never been near that house. And your own admission is that her condition of mind prevents you from producing her anywhere to submit to investigation and to speak for herself. I pass over minor points of evidence on both sides to save time, and I ask you, if this case were to go now to a court of law, to go before a jury, bound to take facts as they reasonably appear, where are your proofs? I was obliged to wait and collect myself before I could answer him. It was the first time the story of Laura and the story of Marion had been presented to me from a stranger's point of view. The first time the terrible obstacles that lay across our path had been made to show themselves in their true character. "There can be no doubt," I said, "that the facts, as you have stated them, appear to tell against us, but you think those facts can be explained away," interposed Mr. Kyle. "Let me tell you the result of my experience on that point. When an English jury has to choose between a plain fact on the surface and a long explanation under the surface, it always takes the fact in preference to the explanation. For example, Lady Glyde, I shall call the lady you represent by that name for argument's sake, declares she has slept at a certain house, and it is proved that she has not slept at that house. You explain this circumstance by entering into the state of her mind, and deducing from it a metaphysical condition. I won't say the conclusion is wrong. I only say that the jury will take the fact of her contradicting herself in preference to any reason for the contradiction that you can offer." "But is it not possible," I urged, "by dint of patience and exertion, to discover additional evidence? Miss Halcombe and I have a few £100. He looked at me with half-suppressed pity and shook his head. "Consider the subject, Mr. Hartright, from your own point of view," he said. "If you are right about Sir Percival Glyde and Count Fosco, which I don't admit, mind, every imaginable difficulty would be thrown in the way of your getting fresh evidence. Every obstacle of litigation would be raised. Every point in the case would be systematically contended. And By the time we had spent our thousands instead of our hundreds, the final result would, in all probability, be against us. Questions of identity, where instances of personal resemblance are concerned, are in themselves the hardest of all questions to settle. The hardest, even when they are free from complications which beset the case we are now discussing. I really see no prospect of throwing any light whatever on this extraordinary affair. Even if the person buried in Limeridge churchyard were not Lady Glyde, she was in life, on your own showing, so like her that we should gain nothing if we applied for the necessary authority to have the body exhumed. In short, there is no case, Mr. Hartwright. There really is no case. I was determined to believe that there was a case, and in that determination shifted my ground and appealed to him once more. Are there not other proofs that we might produce besides the proof of identity? I asked. Not as you are situated, he replied. The simplest and surest of all proofs, the proof of comparison of dates, is, as I understand, altogether out of your reach. If you could show a discrepancy between the date of the doctor's certificate and the date of Lady Glyde's journey to London, the matter would wear a totally different aspect, and I should be the first to say, let us go on. That date may be recovered yet, Mr. Kyle. On the day when it is recovered, Mr. Hartwright, you will have a case. If you have any prospect at this moment of getting at it, tell me, and we shall see if I can advise you. I considered. The housekeeper could not help us. Laura could not help us. Marion could not help us. In all probability, the only person in existence who knew the date were Sir Percival and the Count. I can think of no means of ascertaining the date at present, I said, because I can think of no persons who are sure to know it but Count Fosco and Sir Percival Glyde. Mr. Kyle's calmly attentive face relaxed for the first time into a smile. With your opinion of the conduct of those two gentlemen, he said, you don't expect help in that quarter, I presume. If they have combined to gain large sums of money by a conspiracy, they are not likely to confess it at any rate. They may be forced to confess it, Mr. Kyle. By whom? By me. We both rose. He looked me attentively in the face, with more appearance of interest than he had shown yet. I could see that I had perplexed him a little. You are very determined, he said. You have no doubt a personal motive for proceeding, into which it is not my business to inquire. If a case can be produced in the future, I can only say, my best assistance is at your service. At the same time, I must warn you, as the money question always enters into the law question, that I see little hope, even if you ultimately establish the fact of Lady Glyde's being alive, of recovering her fortune. The foreigner would probably leave the country before proceedings were commenced, and Sir Percival's embarrassments are numerous enough and pressing enough to transfer almost any sum he may possess from himself to his creditors. You are, of course, aware, I stopped him at that point. Let me beg that we not discuss Lady Glyde's affairs, I said. I have never known anything about them in former times, and I know nothing of them now, except that her fortune is lost. You are right in assuming that I have personal motives for stirring in this matter. I wish those motives to be always as disinterested as they are at the present moment. He tried to interpose and explain. I was a little heated, I suppose, by feeling that he had doubted me, and I went on bluntly without waiting to hear him. There shall be no money motive, I said, and no idea of personal advantage in the service I mean to render to Lady Glyde. She has been cast out as a stranger from the house in which she was born. A lie which records her death has been written on her mother's tomb, and there are two men, alive and unpunished, who are responsible for it. That house shall open again to receive her in the presence of every soul who followed the false funeral to the grave. That lie shall be publicly erased from the tombstone by the authority of the head of the family, and those two men shall answer for their crime to me. Though the justice that sits in tribunals is powerless to pursue them, I have given my life to that purpose. And alone as I stand, if God spares me, I will accomplish it. He drew back towards his table and said nothing. His face showed plainly that he thought my delusion had got the better of my reason, and that he considered it totally useless to give me any more advice. We each keep our opinion, Mr. Kyle, I said, and we must await till the events of the future decide between us. In the meantime, I am much obliged to you for the attention you have given to my statement. You've shown me that the legal remedy lies in every sense of the word beyond our means. We cannot produce the law proof, and we are not rich enough to pay the law expenses. It is something gained to know that. I bowed and walked to the door. He called me back and gave me the letter which I had seen him place on the table by itself at the beginning of our interview. "This came by post a few days ago," he said. "Perhaps you will not mind delivering it. Pray tell Miss Halcombe at the same time that I sincerely regret being thus far unable to help her except by advice, which will not be more welcome, I'm afraid, to her than to you." I looked at the letter while he was speaking. It was addressed to Miss Halcombe, care of Messrs. Gilmore and Kyle, Chancery Lane. The handwriting was quite unknown to me. On leaving the room, I asked one last question. "Do you happen to know," I said, "if Sir Percival Glyde is still in Paris?" "He has returned to London," replied Mr. Kyle. "At least, I heard so from his solicitor, whom I met yesterday." After that answer, I went out. On leaving the office, the first precaution to be observed was to abstain from attracting attention by stopping to look about me. I walked towards one of the quietest of the large squares on the north of Holborn, then suddenly stopped and turned round at the place where a long stretch of pavement was left behind me. There were two men at the corner of the square who'd stopped also and were standing talking together. After a moment's reflection, I turned back so as to pass them. One moved as I came near and turned the corner leading from the square into the street. The other remained stationary. I looked at him as I passed and instantly recognized him as one of the men who had watched me before I left England. If I had been free to follow my own instincts, I should probably have begun by speaking to the man and have ended by knocking him down. But I was bound to consider consequences. If I once placed myself publicly in the wrong, I put the weapons at once into Sir Percival's hands. There was no choice but to oppose cunning by cunning. I turned into the street down which the second man had disappeared, and passed him waiting in a doorway. He was a stranger to me, and I was glad to make sure of his personal appearance in case of future annoyance. Having done this, I again walked northward until I reached the new road. There I turned aside to the west, having the men behind me all the time. I waited at a point where I knew myself to be at some distance from a cab stand, until a fast two-wheeled cab, empty, should happen to pass me. One passed in a few minutes. I jumped in and told the man to drive rapidly towards Hyde Park. There was no second fast cab for the spies behind me. I saw them dart across to the other side of the street to follow me by running until a cab or cab stand came in their way. But I had the start of them, and when I stopped the driver and got out, they were nowhere in sight. I crossed Hyde Park and made sure on the open ground that I was free. Then, at last, I turned my steps homeward. It was not until many hours later, not until after dark. I found Marian waiting for me alone in the little sitting room. She had persuaded Laura to go to rest, after first promising to show me her drawing the moment I came in. The poor little dim, faint sketch, so trifling in itself, so touching in its associations, was propped up carefully on the table with two books, and was placed where the faint light of the one candle we allowed ourselves might fall on it to best advantage. I sat down to look at the drawing, and to tell Marian in whispers what had happened. The partition which divided us from the next room was so thin that we could almost hear Laura's breathing, and we might have disturbed her if we had spoken aloud. Marian preserved her composure while I described my interview with Mr. Kyle. But her face became troubled when I spoke next of the men who had followed me from the lawyer's office, and when I told her of the discovery of Sir Percival's return. "Bad news, Walter," she said. "The worst news you could bring. Have you nothing more to tell me?" "I have something to give you," I replied, handing her the note which Mr. Kyle had confided to my care. She looked at the address and recognized the handwriting instantly. "You know your correspondent?" I said. "Too well," she answered. "My correspondent is Count Fosco." With that reply, she opened the note. Her face flushed deeply while she read it. Her eyes brightened with anger as she handed it to me to read in my turn. The note contained these lines.
impelled by honorable admiration, honorable to myself, honorable to you, I write magnificent Marian in the interest of your tranquility. I say two consoling words. Fear nothing. Exercise your fine natural sense and remain in retirement. Dear and admirable woman, invite no dangerous publicity. Resignation is sublime. Adopt it. The modest response of home is eternally fresh. Enjoy it. The storms of life pass harmless over the valley of seclusion. Dwell, dear lady, in the valley. Do this, and I authorize you to fear nothing. No new calamities shall lacerate your sensibilities. Sensibilities precious to me as my own. You shall not be molested. The fair companion of your retreat shall not be pursued. She has found new asylum in your heart. Priceless asylum. I envy her and leave her there. One last word of affectionate warning, of paternal caution, and I tear myself from the charm of addressing you. I close these fervent lines. Advance no farther than you have gone already. Compromise no serious interests. Threaten nobody. Do not, I implore you, force me into action. Me, the man of action, when it is the cherished object of my ambition to be passive, to restrict the vast reach of my energy and my combinations for your sake. If you have rash friends, moderate their deplorable ardor. If Mr. Hartwright returns to England, hold no communication with him. I walk on a path of my own, and a Percival follows at my heels. On the day when Mr. Hartwright crosses that path, he is a lost man.
The only signature to these lines was the initial letter F, surrounded by a circle of intricate flourishes. I threw the letter on the table with all the contempt that I felt for it. "He's trying to frighten you. A sure sign that he's frightened himself," I said. She was too genuine a woman to treat the letter as I had treated it. The insolent familiarity of the language was too much for her self-control. As she looked at me across the table, her hands clenched themselves in her lap, and the old, quick, fiery temper flamed out again brightly in her cheeks and in her eyes. "Walter," she said, "if ever those two men are at your mercy, and if you are obliged to spare one of them, don't let it be the Count." "I will keep this letter, Marian, to help my memory when the time comes." She looked at me attentively as I put the letter away in my pocketbook. "When the time comes," she repeated. "Can you speak of the future as if you were certain of it? Certain after what you've heard in Mr. Kyle's office? After what has happened to you today?" "I don't count the time from today, Marian. All I have done today is to ask another man to act for me. I count from tomorrow." "Why from tomorrow?" "Because tomorrow I mean to act for myself."
"How?"
"I shall go to Blackwater by the first train, and return, I hope, at night."
"To Blackwater?"
"Yes. I've had time to think since I left Mr. Kyle. His opinion on one point confirms my own. We must persist to the last in hunting down the date of Laura's journey. The one weak point in the conspiracy, and probably the one chance of proving that she is a living woman, centre in the discovery of that date."
"You mean," said Marian, "the discovery that Laura did not leave Blackwater Park until after the date of her death on the doctor's certificate?"
"Certainly."
"What makes you think that it might have been after? Laura can tell us nothing of the time she was in London."
"But the owner of the asylum told you that she was received there on the 27th of July. I doubt Count Fosco's ability to keep her in London and to keep her insensible to all that was passing around her more than one night. In that case, she must have started on the 26th and must have come to London one day after the date of her own death on the doctor's certificate. If we can prove that date, we prove our case against Sir Percival and the Count."
"Yes, yes, I see. But how is the proof to be obtained?"
"Mrs. Mitchelson's narrative has suggested to me two ways of trying to obtain it. One of them is to question the doctor, Mr. Dawson, who must know when he resumed his attendance at Blackwater Park after Laura left the house. The other is to make inquiries at the inn to which Sir Percival drove away by himself at night. We know that his departure followed Laura's after a lapse of a few hours, and we may get at the date that way. The attempt is at least worth making, and tomorrow I'm determined it shall be made."
"And suppose it fails?" I look at the worst now, Walter. But I will look at the best if disappointments come to try us. Suppose no one can help you at Blackwater. There are two men who can help me, and shall help me in London. Sir Percival and the Count. Innocent people may well forget the date, but they are guilty, and they know it. If I fail everywhere else, I mean to force a confession out of one or both of them on my own terms. All the woman flushed up in Marian's face as I spoke. Begin with the Count, she whispered eagerly. For my sake, begin with the Count. We must begin, for Laura's sake, where there is the best chance of success, I replied. The colour faded from her face again, and she shook her head sadly. Yes, she said. You're right. It was mean and miserable of me to say that. I try to be patient, Walter, and succeed better now than I did in happier times. But I have a little of my old temper still left, and it will get the better of me when I think of the Count. His turn will come, I said. But remember, there is no weak place in his life that we know of yet. I waited a little to let her recover her self-possession, and then spoke the decisive words. Marian, there is a weak place we both know of in Sir Percival's life.
You mean the secret?
Yes, the secret. It's our only sure hold on him. I can force him from his position of security. I can drag him and his villainy into the face of day by no other means. Whatever the Count may have done, Sir Percival has consented to the conspiracy against Laura from another motive besides the motive of gain. You heard him tell the Count that he believed his wife knew enough to ruin him. You heard him say that he was a lost man if the secret of Anne Catherick was known.
Yes, yes, I did.
Well, Marian, when our other resources have failed us, I mean to know the secret. My old superstition clings to me even yet. I say again, the woman in white is a living influence in our three lives. The end is appointed, the end is drawing us on, and Anne Catherick, dead in her grave, points the way to it still.
Okay, so the last few seconds are that kind of melodramatic, kind of overwrought 1860s prose. But again, you know, this was written as a serial, and so you really need the cliffhanger, and that's a pretty good cliffhanger. Plus, you also now understand where all of these narratives came from. See, I think this is one of the real genius moments of Wilkie Collins, is he's hidden this sort of from us until now, and now is the appropriate time to reveal it. But for his audience, no one really would have questioned how all these first-person narratives were coming about. Or, you know, they wouldn't have worried about kind of the postmodern implications of how is the character speaking to us. You know, none of that would have mattered to them. It would just be a good story. Collins cared, though, and he created a reality that included the necessity of getting all of these narratives written down for us now to read, but also for Hartwright and for Marian and for Laura. So don't forget about the June-July incentive. If you donate between now and July 31st, you get put into a drawing for the new Chop Bard book, Devouring Shakespeare. And also don't forget, if you have the Craftlet app for your phone or iTouch, please do check for some extras for the next while. I'm doing my best to get everything back to where it should be. And I will feel much better about it as that process continues. I hope this finds you well. I hope you have a great week. I will talk to you as soon as I can. It appears that now Sunday morning is pretty much the only chance I have for podcasting. So that will be my appointed day. And I will I'll try and get everything up and out to you by Sunday afternoon. And that's it. Take care. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And Knit Circus online magazine, offering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. And What Would Madame Defarge Knit? A new book of knit and crochet patterns,
coming to you from the Craftlit family. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own Android and iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, your hands are too busy to pick up a book.